Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This week on the podcast Spark and Fire, Apollo Theatre's Camilla Forbes.
I read it in one night. I felt like my heart was gutted out of my soul.
After reading Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates, Camilla was determined to adapt it for the stage.
You said to me, that's not my book. That's yours now.
On Spark and Fire, creators share their stories to fuel your creativity. Spark and Fire is a Wait What original in partnership with the BBC. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts.
Love, Janessa. A brand new true crime podcast from the BBC World Service and CBC Podcasts. It's a story about love, deceit, and survival, and it's available now. Find out more at the end of this podcast.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 2nd of February, these are our main stories. The funeral has taken place of Tyree Nichols, who died after being beaten by police during a traffic stop in the US city of Memphis. Britain has been experiencing its most disruptive days of strikes for a decade as teachers, civil servants and transport workers call for better pay and conditions. Israeli forces have demolished three Palestinian properties in occupied East Jerusalem after a controversial push by the far-right police minister to clear buildings without permits. Also in this podcast...
This sound echoes across Switzerland every year on the first Wednesday in February.
So, why is peaceful Switzerland resounding to the noise of sirens? We begin in the US city of Memphis. You are my strength. The funeral has taken place of Tyree Nichols, an African-American man who died after being beaten by police officers in the city last month. Mr. Nichols died 3 days after being stopped by police for an alleged traffic violation. Graphic footage showed him being punched, kicked and hit with a baton. Five officers involved in the incident have been arrested on charges including second-degree murder. Well, hundreds of mourners, including the civil rights leader Reverend Al Sharpton, attended the service in the Mississippi Boulevard Christian Church. Rovon Wells is Tyree Nichols' mother.
First of all, I want to thank each and every one of you for coming out to pay tribute to my son. Tyree was a beautiful person. And for this to happen to him is just unimaginable.
Well, the U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris was also among the mourners.
This violent act was not in pursuit of public safety. It was not in the interest of keeping the public safe, because one must ask, was not it in the interest of keeping the public safe that Tyree Nichols would be with us here today? Was he not also entitled to the right to be safe?
I've been speaking to our US correspondent, Neda Torfik. So this was an opportunity to remember Mr. Nichols, but it was also a chance for people to campaign for police reform.
This was a situation where you had the community coming together in Memphis, a majority black community, saying that Tyree Nichols is one in a long line of African-Americans who have been killed at the hands of police. And we saw the family of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor all there. And so the theme throughout all of this was that this journey won't end with Tyree, that it is a continuous fight. And you heard, for example, the Reverend Al Sharpton. He has spoken at many eulogies in the past like this. He said he's lost count at the number of people that have died at the hands of police that he's spoken at their funerals. And he really spoke about the pain of this happening by five black officers. He said, you know, Martin Luther King was assassinated in Memphis, and he went there to support sanitation workers, city workers. He said, here we have five black men who wouldn't have their jobs in the police department if it wasn't for Dr. King. And so so he said the most offensive thing about all of this has been that these officers who walked through the door that others in the civil rights movement opened for them then acted this way, beating another man of color. So he spoke about that pain and said that, you know, this is just one more fight that they have to wage in the United States to make sure that Black Americans are treated with equal justice.
And Neda, there is a specific law that's in the offing, isn't there, to reform the police. What would it do and where are we with that?
It's called the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. And again, throughout the funeral, it was this common theme that we have to pass this act. His mother, in fact, saying that the blood of others will be on whoever's hands who doesn't pass this bill. What it seeks to do is to basically increase the powers of the Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division to issue subpoenas when they see patterns of misconduct in police units. They want to lower standards of qualified immunity so that in civil cases, police can face justice, other things like this to make sure they can get rid of excessive force.
And at the moment, it's stuck in Congress?
That's right. Right now, we have a slim majority in the House that is controlled by Republicans, a slim majority in the Senate controlled by Democrats. So right now, it doesn't look like it's a positive environment to pass anything.
Neda Torfik. Well, staying in the US, and President Biden's personal lawyer, Bob Bauer, has said that a search of the president's beach house in Delaware has concluded and no documents with classified markings have been found. Federal officers had been searching the premises after classified documents from his time as vice president were found at other properties linked to him. Mr. Biden's lawyers said Wednesday's search was pre-planned with the president's full support. Jane Hill spoke to the BBC's North America correspondent Gary O'Donoghue as the search in Delaware was taking place.
This is the second time in 2 weeks that the FBI have gone into Joe Biden's homes and started rummaging through the sock drawer and elsewhere to look for classified documents. You'll remember that he's already disclosed that a number of classified documents were found at a think tank he was part of in Washington, also at his Wilmington home, which is the capital of Delaware, and then this house on the beach at Rehoboth. They're searching that as well. The key thing here is that his lawyers first searched both his own private homes, came up with some documents. The FBI went back and found some more. So they're clearly not satisfied that the lawyers looked hard enough. And that's why this second search is taking place. But being done with the cooperation of the president, still quite a spectacle, a sitting president having the FBI in their homes looking through their stuff.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this far in this story, am I right in saying that the president or his team have always tried to explain why the documents are there, what sort of things they are? Is that the situation we're in? Because when you talk about searching for documents, of course, it takes you back to the search of Donald Trump's home in Florida.
Yeah, I mean, these were inadvertent, as the words they've been using, that they were left behind by mistake. It's the same thing that Mike Pence said, the former Republican vice president, about the documents that were found at his home. These cases, both Pence and Biden, are slightly different to that of Donald Trump, of course, who resisted handing back documents for months and months. The FBI subpoenaed him. Then they invoked a search warrant of his home in Mar-a-Lago and found more top secret documents and are now investigating potential charges under the Espionage Act and obstruction, as well as the general laws that govern classified documents. So the cases are a bit different. Nevertheless, Joe Biden is under investigation by a special counsel. That is a serious business for anyone. The fact that they are still going through his home means they don't really trust the fact that the lawyers have had a look. They want to make sure for themselves there's nothing else there. And this will be something that will be a cloud over the president's head for the next few months at least.
Gary O'Donoghue in Washington. Up to 500,000 workers in Britain took part in strikes on Wednesday, causing major disruption to education, transport and other services. It's thought to be the biggest industrial action in the UK in a decade. There's anger that public sector salaries in particular aren't keeping up with rampant inflation. Unions say hospitals and schools are underfunded and understaffed. The British government argues that big wage rises are unaffordable and would only make inflation worse. Its focus instead is bringing down the rate of inflation. Our education editor, Branwyn Jeffries, reports.
Across England, teachers joined rallies and picket lines. Momentum behind strike action had been growing. The National Education Union said 43,000 new members had joined in the past week. And across England and Wales, more than 200,000 were on strike. This dispute is about the 5% increase given to most teachers this year. The union is asking for a pay rise matching inflation, currently over 10%. Independent analysis shows experienced teachers have seen a 13% fall in the value of their pay since 2010, although the starting salary in England will reach £30,000 next year. On a picket line in Harlow, Carla Mounsey-Jaggers said she was on strike not just for herself, but for younger colleagues who she sees struggling.
They're having to take second jobs in the evening because they can't afford the petrol to drive into work. My partner teacher and other teachers around school, I know teachers within my school who have to take second jobs outside of working hours at school because they can't afford to live.
There is no complete picture of the impact today, but the government said most secondary schools restricted opening or closed, with just under half of primary schools doing the same. That left some parents struggling to work, including Alison Dickinson, who's self-employed. She'd had to call on family to help with her 8-year-old daughter.
It's very hard because I'm a single parent, so having my daughter at home, that one-on-one, does have a massive impact on my working day, so I have had to call on family, on my father, to come and help.
Ministers have described the strike, and three more to come, as deeply disappointing. The Education Secretary, Gillian Keegan, said she was listening to teachers and talks with unions were trying to address wider issues such as workload. So far, talks have not led to any revised offer, in line with the government's position that public sector pay increases could contribute to inflation.
Branwyn Jeffries. Israeli forces have demolished at least three Palestinian properties in occupied East Jerusalem. The move follows a promise by the country's far-right police minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, to step up the clearance of buildings without construction permits. Here's Tom Bateman.
Standing in front of the ruins of his demolished cafe, Awad Abu Sabi described his shock at seeing the Israeli bulldozers arrive. His was one of three Palestinian buildings, including a home, demolished in occupied East Jerusalem on Wednesday morning. These demolitions are not unusual, but their rate appears to have increased in the last week, coinciding with the current sharp surge in tensions. Israel says such buildings don't have construction permits, but these are almost impossible for Palestinians to get, and such demolitions are deemed by the UN as part of a coercive environment.
Tom Bateman. The flagship company of one of the world's richest men, the Indian billionaire Gautam Adani, has made a dramatic U-turn and will return $2.5 billion to investors poised to buy new shares in the firm. A damning report by a US investment firm led to a mass sell-off of shares, wiping more than $80 billion off the Adani Group's value. Here's Jonathan Josephs.
Adani Enterprises had been trying to raise more money from investors to help fuel its growth. It did that successfully, but has decided to refund the cash because of the volatility caused by what it says are extraordinary circumstances. That's a reference to the more than $80 billion that's been wiped off the group's value in the last few days, which came after a US investment firm accused it of brazen stock manipulation and accounting fraud.
Next to Myanmar. Impractical, that's what the military rulers of the country have called the plan to hold elections this August, and they extended the state of emergency for another 6 months. The man who led the military coup 2 years ago, Min Aung Hlaing, said that the continued armed resistance made an election impossible. There is now a full-blown civil war with armed opposition groups fighting against the military government. All this in a country whose healthcare system has collapsed. Doctors and nurses were some of the first to say they wouldn't work for the military. Some were arrested, others fled. Our reporter Coco Wang met one of the rebel nurses.
A small team are crowded around a medical emergency in a rebel camp deep in the jungle in central Myanmar. A young fighter has just had a stroke.
He can't move himself. His nerves and the veins in his brain are not working.
Nurse Shui Piu is the only healthcare person around. She is keeping him alive for the hours it takes, rubbing his palms, moving his limbs, and constantly checking his nerves, waiting for the critical medicines to be smuggled in. Shui Piu used to practice in a major hospital, but after the coup, like many other healthcare workers, she refused to work for the military. Shui Piu says she soon had to go on the run.
They filed a case at the police station, and I needed to sort it out. They didn't give me any details. They just told me to report by 4 p.m. at the latest to the hospital, or I would be in trouble.
She discarded her phone and fled, leaving her home, her job, and her family. Now she is fighting back in her own way, treating people in rubble-held areas. Riding on motorbikes through the thick forest and deep ravines of central Myanmar, Shui Piu is arriving with her small team for another life-saving mission. The loudspeaker is hanging from the branches of a tree, calling locals to make the most of the rare chance to receive health care. They come with essential medicines donated by the public. For the villagers here, she is the only lifeline. The army can attack any time, so the nurse has to hide her medicines. Storage in the jungle is hard, but they need somewhere safe.
We have to clean these.
Because of the military blockade, they have to smuggle in life-saving materials like their contrabands.
Look at this. These have been damaged by rats and termites.
As they set up their mobile clinic, patients gather, men, women and children. Shui Piu had to leave her five-year-old behind when she fled, so it's an emotional encounter.
Sometimes when children come for treatment, I think they look like my daughter, speak like my child, and I miss her. I treat those children the best I can, like I would do for my child.
She shows a video of her daughter singing a traditional nursery rhyme. "Don't leave me alone," she sings.
I'm her mother. I carried her in my womb. Of course, I miss her. I miss her so much.
But now, explosions are an almost daily hazard in Shui Piu's life. She works as a nurse for a rebel group supported by the parallel government fighting to restore democracy since the military coup. She is a bigger target now than she has ever been. Back in the camp, the young fighter is recovering from the stroke.
Any headaches?
Yes, sometimes I feel dizzy all of a sudden.
Shui Piu says every patient she can save is a small victory over the military.
You need to keep yourself warm.
It's another day, another trip, and another fight.
That report was by Coco Ung in Myanmar. Switzerland is famously militarily neutral. A treaty dating back to 1815 guarantees that status. But that doesn't mean it takes its own security lightly, far from it. All men have to do at least 5 months military service. And then there's the system of sirens that sounded out across the towns, hills and valleys in its annual test on Wednesday. It's a system that was developed in the 1930s to warn the population of impending attack or natural disaster. In recent years, it began to be regarded as a bit of a Cold War relic. This year is different, as Imogen Folks reports from Bern.
This sound echoes across Switzerland every year on the first Wednesday in February. 7,000 warning sirens are tested simultaneously. A loud reminder of just how prepared the Swiss are, or think they are, for emergencies. Today is also the day citizens should check their nuclear bunkers are in full working order. Swiss law says there should be space in a bunker for every member of the population. Having stayed out of two world wars, neutral Switzerland formed a strategy to stay out of and survive the next one. When the Cold War ended, those precautions began to look a bit silly. Many household bunkers were transformed into wine cellars or storage for skis. But today is the first time the sirens have been tested since Russia invaded Ukraine. The Swiss, too, have heard Vladimir Putin's nuclear saber-rattling, and many will be checking their bunkers a bit more thoroughly. At the same time, community outreach is underway to reassure the 75,000 Ukrainian refugees in Switzerland who may not know about the siren system that there is no reason to be alarmed, because that sound, today at least, is only a test.
Imogen Folks in Switzerland. Still to come. Ozzy Osbourne, one of heavy metal's greats, says his touring days are over. We look back at his on- and off-stage antics. In Britain, the Royal Navy says it's investigating a safety defect on one of its nuclear submarines. An inspection of HMS Vanguard discovered that sheared bolts in the submarine's reactor compartment had been glued back rather than replaced during maintenance. The Minister of Defence says that there were no nuclear safety implications. Our defence correspondent Jonathan Beale reports.
HMS Vanguard, one of the Royal Navy's four Trident nuclear-armed submarines, has been in deep maintenance for the past 7 years, work which was meant to have been completed more than 2 years ago. The defect was discovered in January while the submarine was in dry dock in Plymouth. Inspectors found that broken bolts attaching coolant pipes in the reactor compartment had been glued rather than screwed back in place. The original bolts had sheared because they'd been fixed too tightly. The Ministry of Defence said the faulty work was promptly reported and fixed. With the reactor turned off at the time, it said there was no nuclear safety implications. But the Defence Secretary, Ben Wallace, was concerned enough to ask for a meeting with the chief executive of Babcock, the main contractor, to seek assurances about future work. In a statement, Babcock said any quality-related issue was a huge disappointment. It added that its own robust inspection process discovered the issue.
Jonathan Beale. The co-hosts of the Women's World Cup, New Zealand, have criticised a decision to make Saudi Arabia's tourist authority a major sponsor of the tournament. FIFA has not yet confirmed the deal officially. More from our sports news correspondent, Alex Capstick.
FIFA insiders claim the agreement with Saudi Arabia, which hasn't yet been formally announced, will provide a significant commercial boost to the women's game. But according to tournament organisers in New Zealand and Australia, they've been kept in the dark and have not been consulted about the deal. A statement from the New Zealand FA said they're shocked and disappointed by the reports and, along with their counterparts in Australia, have written to FIFA seeking clarification. While steps have been taken in Saudi over recent years to develop women's football, their involvement as sponsors of the World Cup is certain to be controversial.
That was Alex Capstick. Now, a question for coffee drinkers everywhere. Do you know just how much caffeine you're getting in your cup? Here in the UK, a survey by the consumer group Which has measured the strength of the brews in several high street chains and found that caffeine levels vary widely, with some six times stronger than others. For example, a medium cappuccino at Costa Coffee has five times more caffeine in it than the Starbucks equivalent. Most of us wouldn't have guessed that, I think, but we may subtly find ourselves drawn to one coffee with more kick than another. So what exactly is our relationship to and with caffeine, and should we be wary of it? One possible caffeine addict is Evan Davis, who spoke to Michael Mosley, a doctor and a BBC presenter on radio. Also, he spoke to Lindsay Harley, founder of Modern Standard Coffee in the Scottish city of Edinburgh. Evan first asked Lindsay if she measured the amount of caffeine in her coffee.
We don't measure caffeine, but we have an occasion for customers. But I'm not surprised by this, because I think what people need to understand is that how a coffee's made will determine how much caffeine. So is there more grams in the cup? Is it extracted for longer? And then obviously, what blend is it? Because Robusta has twice as much caffeine as Arabica beans. So all those factors play into how much caffeine will come into your cup of coffee.
Right. Do users ever ask about it? It's not something that I've ever really thought about asking. You know, is this a strong one or a weak one? I suppose there are ratings on coffees you see in shops sometimes, but is it something people talk about, ask about?
No, not really. I think for the consumer, I really look at the numbers 1 to 5, and that really is an indication of roast level. But when it comes to actual caffeine content, higher grown coffees, so Arabica coffees, have less caffeine in them naturally, because caffeine kills the pest, basically. So when the higher grown coffees will just not have as much caffeine in them. So I think consumers may not know that. So lower grown coffees, which are more like Robustas, which are more commonly found in your Italian style coffees, your Neros and your Costas, have more caffeine in them.
If I get a big one, very diluted with a sort of bucket of milk, which I don't personally, but if I did, that presumably has quite a lot of caffeine in. It's just you don't notice it because it's very diluted as you're drinking it, whereas a bitter espresso may actually have less caffeine in if you've only just got one shot.
Yeah, no milk, and obviously sugar or syrups or anything like that will hide that bitterness you find in coffee. So it's always good to maybe just try the espresso first and then make your choice about how many shots you want to have in your cup.
Michael, tell us about caffeine. Why do I like it in the morning, especially as I get up?
Absolutely. The reason you like it is because it's a neurostimulant. It basically, makes you get up and go. It's also kind of good for mood. I was surprised by the dose that you could get in a Costa coffee, because that was close to what is regarded as a sort of maximum dose, which is around 400 milligrams. And what it chiefly does is it actually blocks the action of another chemical called adenosine, which makes you feel sleepy. So when you drink the coffee, it just blocks, it kind of defers the sleepiness rather than necessarily making you feel that much more energetic.
Yeah, you're telling us in technical language, I think, stuff that we sort of knew about coffee, really, that keeps
Absolutely.
You awake. But does it have actually bad effects? Because obviously, if you drink it too late in the day, it may well affect your sleep, and that is not good. It is. But does it have other bad effects, the caffeine?
Yes, I mean, it raises your blood pressure. I've measured my blood pressure immediately after drinking, or within 20 minutes of drinking caffeine, and it shoots up and then it goes down again. One bit of advice I came across when I was making the Just One Thing podcast was try not to drink it first thing. And the reason is because when you roll out of bed, your cortisol levels, your stress hormones are already rising. They're basically, it's called the CAR response, cortisol arousal response, and that's what gets you going in the morning. So if you pour coffee on top of that, that's just going to make you feel more anxious, because one of the things that caffeine does is boost your levels of cortisol. So the advice I had was try to defer that coffee until breakfast time. Otherwise, you get a big surge of blood sugars and things which you don't really want.
That was Dr. Michael Mosley, and before him, Lindsay Harley from the Modern Standard Coffee in Edinburgh. Now, he made a name for himself as one of the true godfathers of heavy metal, but it was often his off-stage antics that guaranteed Ozzy Osbourne a place as one of the wildest men in rock and roll. Now, at the age of 74, the former Black Sabbath frontman has announced that he is retiring from touring because of ill health. All the shows on his farewell tour of the UK and Europe have been cancelled. This report by Carly Swain.
My singing voice is fine, however, my body is still physically weak. That's what Ozzy Osbourne put out in a statement on social media, a reference to a string of operations, treatments, and his struggle to recover from a spine injury. The star was hurt in a fall 4 years ago, which aggravated injuries he suffered in a near-fatal quad bike accident in 2003. He's suffered a number of other health problems in recent years too, from COVID to Parkinson's disease. Last year, he also had major back and neck surgery, which was a success, but left him in agony. In his statement, Ozzy thanked his fans for their endless dedication and for giving him the life he never dreamed he would have.
Carly Swain reporting there. And finally, or in this case, it may not be, A company in the United States has announced a plan to bring back the dodo, a flightless bird which became extinct more than 300 years ago. Well, the process involves genetically altering pigeons, and the team working on the project says the experiment could provide insights into the dodo's existence. But many scientists believe that the project is unlikely to succeed. Here's our science correspondent, Pallab Ghosh.
The idea is simple enough. Scientists make genetic changes to a pigeon embryo so that the offspring resembles a dodo. But that's much easier said than done, according to many experts in the field. It can take years of research to work out how to alter the function of a single gene. And the physical differences between a pigeon and a dodo are so great that it's likely that hundreds of genes would have to be identified, tweaked, and the results tested out to make the necessary changes, according to Professor Robin Lovell-Badge of the Crick Institute in London.
This is really ambitious because you're going to have to make a lot of changes in the genome. They've got to identify which are the critical changes to make. It's going to be an enormous effort, and the question is it worth it?
There are also concerns about animal welfare. Early attempts may lead to birds that don't survive or experience suffering. And even if the researchers are successful in creating a dodo-like animal, it's far from certain that the creatures won't go extinct again if they return to their natural habitat.
That was Pallab Ghosh. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics that we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Stuart Willey. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
When you meet someone online, can you trust they are who they say they are?
I keep thinking so much about you.
She's so stunning.
It's all well planned.
Love, Janessa is the true crime podcast from the BBC World Service and CBC Podcasts, investigating the murky world of online romance scams.
She was trying to get me to send her money.
And it's available now.
You win their hearts, you win their wallets.
Search for Love, Janessa wherever you found this podcast.
This week on the podcast Spark and Fire, Apollo Theater's Camilla Forbes.
I read it in one night. I felt like my heart was gutted out of my soul.
After reading Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates, Camilla was determined to adapt it for the stage.
He said to me, "That's not my book. That's yours now."
On Spark and Fire, creators share their stories to fuel your creativity. Spark and Fire is a Wait What original in partnership with the BBC. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts.